Gardner. I'm thrilled to be with you here today. I'm going to keep my remarks pretty brief. I'd love to have a conversation. We've got some time for Q&A, so please think of all the hard questions. I'd love to have them in a couple moments. It's been an amazing 2 years, and I came to Washington with a healthy sense of skepticism. Wasn't quite sure what you could do from this vantage point, but I think the change we've seen around the country has been pretty extraordinary. You have 40 states that have raised standards, not just anything we in Washington have done, but governors and state school chiefs, officers and boards and superintendents stepping up and saying, we're tired of lying to children, we're tired of dumbing things down, we're going to raise the bar. You have 44 states working together on the next generation of assessments, recognizing what we're doing today isn't good enough. You've got to get past those film and bubble tests. You've got to think about critical thinking skills. Really, are we preparing students to be successful in a globally competitive 21st century economy? We have almost 1,000 schools this year around the country that are being turned around. This is tough work, challenging work, I think critically important work, definitely controversial work, but where we have dropout factories where 50, 60, 70% of students aren't making it, where we see students falling further and further behind. I think we don't have just an educational obligation, we have a moral obligation to challenge the status quo. And what's been amazing to me in this work is there's been real quiet. The media hates it. There hasn't been huge controversy. Things haven't blown up. Folks just sitting down with courage and doing the right thing for our children and our nation. So it's been a remarkable amount of change, remarkable amount of momentum that I feel today. But we know we have a long, long way to go. And people probably know these three facts, but these are three facts that haunt me every single night, and they create such a sense of urgency for me. First, as a country, we've gone from first in the world to ninth in the world in college graduates in one generation. So just a generation ago, we were the international leader. It's interesting, it's not so much that we've dropped, we've just flatlined, we've stagnated. The other countries have just passed us by. They're out educating us, they're out investing us, we're paying a real price for that. Secondly, we have about a 25% dropout rate in this country. It's about 1 million of our young people leaving our schools for our streets each year. That is, again, both morally unacceptable and economically unsustainable. In many districts, including the district I'm from in Chicago, that number, particularly in the minority community, approaches 50%. How are we going to create a great country? We have that many children leaving our schools for the streets. There are no good jobs out there today, none, in the legal economy for a high school dropout. And then finally, if you look at the recent PISA results, English, math, science, different benchmarks, the United States ranks anywhere from 15th to 30th among 15-year-olds. So for all the progress, for all of our hard work here collectively, the honest truth, sometimes the brutal truth, is that as a country, we are nowhere close. We're not even close to where we need to be looking at any of those metrics. High school dropout rates, how our 15-year-olds are doing relative to the rest of the world, looking at college graduation rates. So we have to continue to work together. We have to continue to challenge the status quo. We all have to move outside our comfort zones. And we have to educate our way to a better economy. This is for our children. For all of our communities, but it's ultimately for the country. The president, I think, has shown unbelievable courage and leadership on this. He's called now, today, our Sputnik moment. If you watched or listened to the State of the Union, I don't know if you've ever seen a president spend that much time in education. I promise you, ladies and gentlemen, that's just the beginning. He's going to keep coming back, keep coming back. He gets this, this is not just an intellectual issue for him. This is one that really hits him in his heart. He's got absolute passion on it. So we have to figure out what we can do together to give all of our children a chance to be successful and to strengthen our country again. Make it a great, great country to lead the world in education. That's got to be the goal. The president said by 2020, we have to get lead the world in college graduates, so everything is towards that end. How do we get there? We have to continue to support the great reform at the local level that so many of you are driving. We have to, again, move outside our comfort zones and do something differently. We're hosting a conference next week in Denver, Colorado, that all I know you and your team is coming to. This is one that has never been done before. We're trying to bring the local chair, the president of the board, the local president of the teachers union, and the superintendent, chancellor, and the title is together. Teams of three coming together to say, how do we work in a different way, and student achievement becomes the focal point of everything we're doing. It's high risk. Some folks are taking some real risks coming to this. It's so interesting to me how many folks are so scared about spending a day and a half together. I think that speaks to, maybe a little funny, it makes me actually cringe, to be honest. It takes that much, that sense of risk, that much courage to simply say, how do we come together and do something better for our children? We were concerned additionally, if we had moved about 150 districts, we were concerned maybe only 30 or 40 would be willing to come. We had over 250 apply. We actually had about 100 districts, and we just simply couldn't take. We had to figure out how to keep working with them. But what this tells me, again, there's a huge appetite led by so many of you for change, for reform, for doing business in a very different manner. If we can have these collective bargaining contracts, if they can be about student achievement, if we can put things in place that help support our teachers and help students learn, that can be a vehicle for change rather than a vehicle for maintaining the status quo. It simply isn't good enough. Secondly, we have to reauthorize NCLB this year to fix so much of this. I lived on the other side of the law for 7.5 years. I ran Chicago Public Schools, so I have my own perspective of the many things that I think are broken, and I walk those things through. Just to talk on the, you're here watching, talking about politics for a moment. For all the craziness you see coming out of Washington, so many issues, and it is pretty crazy sometimes, I have to admit. On education, I think you see a real bipartisan consensus emerging. And while there's no guarantees that this could work, if you ask me today, and I'm here today, I'm actually very hopeful, very optimistic. Republicans, Democrats, House, Senate, I've been spending a tremendous amount of time with political leadership on both sides of the aisle. Everybody sees what's not working. Everybody sees the disincentives or the perverse incentives in the current law, and we have a chance to work together. I think what the country's asking for Washington to do is to fix things. And that if we don't fix things, then everybody gets thrown out and they go back home. And as I've traveled the country to Republican districts, Democratic districts, it's interesting now. Chairman Klein, who's going to chair the Health Committee in the House, was out in Minnesota a week and a half ago. He's about 27 schools. In the next year or two, 26 of them are going to be labeled as failures. And he has some fantastic schools, as are around the country. And we know we have struggling schools. We're pushing harder than anyone to challenge the status quo. But we know we have amazing schools all around the country. And when 95, 96, 97% of schools will be labeled failures in the next couple of years, what message does that send to our children? What message does that send to our hardworking employees? What message does that send to our broader community? We have to change that. And so I think we have a real chance to work together to find that common ground in the middle and do the right thing for our children and the right thing for the country. What's broken there? A number of things. The law is very, very punitive. About 50 different ways to fail. Basically, no rewards for success. The only reward for success is you're not able to fail. That has to change. The law is very prescriptive, very top-down from Washington. I tell people all the time that a couple of years ago, I almost had to sue our Department of Education for the right to tutor my children after school back home in Chicago. It made no sense whatsoever. I got in a huge battle with them. Luckily, I won. But why did I have to fight the federal government to tutor tens of thousands of children after school who wanted to get better, who wanted to work harder? Why was that an obstacle? It didn't make any sense at all. The law, I think this is probably unintentional, but the law led to a dumbing down of standards. We saw many states reduce standards, not because it's good for children or education, for the economy, but because it made politicians look good. And then finally, the biggest complaint I've heard from teachers and parents and principals and school board members around the country is it led to a narrowing of the curriculum. So we have to fix all of those things, and I absolutely think we can. We have to raise the bar. We have to reward excellence, great schools, great school districts, great states that are proven achievement for all, closing gaps at the same time. We have to shine a spotlight on excellence. And I think for all the challenges we face, we're actually going to talk about somewhere in the country today, every single day, those challenges are being solved. We have to shine a spotlight. We have to learn from it. We have to replicate it. We have to share those best practices. But we don't need any great ideas coming from Washington. We just need to emulate and learn from what you guys are doing out there every single day. So we have to reward excellence. We have to provide much more flexibility. Stop trying to micromanage things in Washington. When I ran the Chicago Public Schools, I couldn't micromanage things in the schools. Now that I'm in Washington, I don't dream of trying to micromanage 95,000 schools. Can't do it. I think the grand trade-off here is if we raise the bar, high standards, college career-ready standards for every single child, let's give local districts much more flexibility. Let them be entrepreneurs. Let them be innovators. Give them the room to hit that higher bar. They know what their children need. They know what their community needs. Give them the room to move. Again, Republicans, Democrats, that resonates with everyone. Third, we have to raise standards. And the huge heavy lift there is already basically done. 41 states plus District of Columbia have already raised standards. College and career-ready standards, huge breakthrough. Happy to talk about that. but just, I think, a profiling courage of governors and state school chief officers, school boards saying, we're tired of lying to children, we're tired of dumbing things down, we're going to raise the bar. And then finally, we have to have a well-rounded education for every single child. So yes, reading's important, yes, math's important, but science, social studies, foreign languages, dance, drama, art, music, physical education. Environmental literacy, financial literacy, all of our children deserve a rich curriculum. I would say if you want to do a math course, try some music. Let's think about things a little bit differently here. And to me, this can't just be at the high school level. It's got to be for our babies, our first, our second, our third graders. So as part of our budget proposal, we're asking for Congress $1 billion to invest in districts that want to support what we're calling a well-rounded education. And those that are willing to broaden the curriculum and do more, we're going to put unprecedented resources behind that. Final thing I'll say is I saw The Tale of Two Cities last Monday, a week ago today, on a trip to Atlanta, to Gwinnett County. So I went to Gwinnett County, Rhodes Prize winner, extraordinary board. One board member's been there 38 years. Real stability, superintendent's been there 12, 13 years. Doing an amazing job, tough demographic challenges, closing the achievement gap, routine. They have school after school, there's basically 90% poverty, 90% minority, 90% hitting the bar. Remarkable work. We talked about they have two types of people in their school system, teachers, and the other type of person is people who support teachers doing the real work. Really interesting concept. Great, great work. Then in Atlanta, unfortunately, we have tremendous board dysfunction. And the Atlanta Public Schools are in danger of losing their accreditation because the board forgot why they got into this work. It's become personal. And you have children, again, with a tremendous dropout rate for all the progress Atlanta's made. You have children who were being done a great disservice today because adults at the board level have lost sight of what they're doing. It was interesting to me that when the accreditation came in and challenged them, the first thought wasn't say, how do we start to get back in line, how do we get this going again? The first thought was to challenge the findings of the accreditor. So a real sense of denial there. So it just was both extraordinary and inspiring, but also heartbreaking the same day, just two visits happened to be there on Monday, to see both the extraordinary power that board members have to drive change and to lead districts where they need to go. For me, at some point, to sustain that. So last year after year after year, so it's not a flash in the pan, and other places where the leadership is actually hurting children. But I thank all of you for your extraordinary commitment. I know how hard this work is. You guys are being asked to do more with less, and the work has never been more important. We all have to find ways, again, to be much more creative, to be more innovative. Of your continued leadership and your passion for all those challenges I've talked about, I'm absolutely convinced in the years ahead, America will again lead the world in public education. Thank you so much, and happy to take any questions you might have.
If you've ever been in a session where I've been the moderator, I'm going to give you the ground rules on how to ask a question. Questions begin with words like how, what, when, where, why, could, would. I will give you a little latitude to set it up, but don't be offended if I ask you what's the question, okay? Everybody understand what the ground rules are, because I wasn't for it. I'm going to start it off myself and give you an example of what I would accept. Secretary Duncan.
Yes, sir.
Given that you have already acknowledged that the current accountability system under No Child Left Behind is unfair and flawed, will you support deferral of the most costly sanctions if the reauthorization is not completed this year?
First of all, I'm going to take you on the road with me, because every time I get Q&A, I need somebody helping me. So, we'll be part of our fellowship. So, my whole mindset, my whole mentality now is to get this thing passed. And I would urge all of you to join me in that fight. If we have to, at the end of the day, things don't work, figure out what we do to create some waivers or to provide some relief at the local level, we'll cross that bridge at the end of the day. But you have to think about, we have 15,000 school districts out here. If we're doing this in one-offs, it's a very difficult situation to be in. I think we need to fix this for the entire country. We need to do it now. If we don't do it now, I don't think what happened next year. And so my entire mindset now is let's get this done. I would love to have this law passed on the president's desk before we go back to school in the fall. And so this is real time.
Thank you.
want to push as hard as we can, again, in a bipartisan way, to do the right thing, not in pockets, but the right thing for the entire country.
I will move from mic to mic. I saw the microphone, the second microphone first, and then I'll come to the first and go back and forth. And please ask your question in the spirit of respect and civility. Back microphone.
Thank you, Earl. I'm Stuart Gibson. I'm the school board in Fairfax County, Virginia, where we're raising achievement and lowering achievement gaps for 175,000 students every day. My question is, why, in the face of overwhelming empirical evidence that incentive pay does not improve performance and, in fact, may lower performance, do you insist on spending hundreds of millions of dollars on incentive pay for teachers?
Really fair question. And I think there's a wide divergence of opinions on this issue, and you and I might disagree a little bit. First of all, we have a couple hundred million that we support in that fund. What's been interesting is we only go to places where management and boards and unions want to do this work. So we did this in Chicago. We only went to schools where 75% of teachers were asking for. And I think, like everything else, the devil's in the details is how you set programs up. I would absolutely agree with you that many programs have been fundamentally instruction flawed. Where you put pit teachers against each other, where it's a zero-sum game, where you're closing down things, I think that creates real problems. Where you're incenting not just teachers, but everyone in the school building to do well, the cook, the janitor, the security guard, the principal, the teachers, lunchroom attendants, when everyone's working together to drive change, particularly in disadvantaged communities. I think we have very few incentives for great, great talent to go into disadvantaged communities, be that inner city, urban, or rural. These kinds of incentive programs have actually been very appealing to folks who want to do that hard work. And so it's not something where we're going to mandate, it's not something that you have to do, but there was actually a tremendous waiting list for districts that wanted our resources to do this work. So if you feel it's not the right answer for you, we more than respect that. There are hundreds of districts around the country who would love to get those hands those resources.
Microphone in front.
John Herbert, school director from Pasco, Washington, and I'm going to ask a question about the school improvement grants that have come out again. And our school district has chosen not to apply for them this year because we do not think that it's fair. And how is here's my question. Thank you for the reminder of that. How is it fair to judge an elementary school, a middle school, or a high school based on an English-only test given to students that do not speak little or no English. And instead of looking at it from a systemic approach, where are they in third grade, and where do they end up by the time they're in high school?
So I agree with you. These list of schools on the school improvement grant list, those aren't our list. Those are generated at the state level. What we said to states is just give us the bottom 5% of schools. So every state has high-performing schools and struggling schools. We said don't give us a 19 and 20, give the 1 and 20 where things simply aren't improving. And if states are using the wrong set of metrics or aren't looking at a set of factors, let's have that conversation. My only point was that we have many, many schools around the country that have been failing for decades. And under the NCLB, the thing was interesting to me that the school in that last category of improvement, 89% of the country picked other. Know what other was. Other was the status quo. So if schools are on the list for the wrong reasons, we encourage schools to appeal and to challenge that. But when you have schools where 50, 60, 70% of students are dropping out, we have schools where students are falling further and further behind, then I'm going to have that hard conversation.
That's not the case in our school district. These kids aren't doing it, and I appreciate your
I don't know the detail, but I will tell you there are many, many schools and districts who have appealed to their states and have some really good conversations. I'll tell you what's really interesting to me in this whole process is many states had no idea who their bottom 5% of schools were. So we'll be a little provocative here. We're trying to force some conversations, and if they got that wrong, I apologize. I would encourage you to really state your case and be very clear there.
Okay, thank you.
Recognize the young lady at the microphone in the back, second microphone.
Hi, thank you for being here, Secretary Duncan. My name is Jen Little. Proudly representing the Commonwealth of Virginia, and I'm honored to serve on the Matthews County School Board, where we have one of the lowest dropout rates in the Commonwealth of Virginia, and with less than 1%, I'm going to say probably the nation. And my question for you is, we are doing what we are supposed to do, and we have accountability, and we're achieving our benchmarks, we have meet our AYP, we do everything that we're supposed to do, and are there plans in the works to help school divisions that are doing what they're supposed to do financially so that we can continue to do a good job in our schools and have the technology, the teachers, and the resources needed to prepare our children for the 21st century?
A lot there, and I think the answer is yes. And again, let me be very clear. I think, going back to where I started, in our country, I think we've been far too shy, for some reason I don't understand, afraid to spotlight excellence. And where you have high-performing schools, high-performing districts, and high-performing states, we want to shine a huge spotlight on that. And yes, give more resources to those places who can demonstrate and help to prove to the country what's possible. And so that's part of, as we talk about reauthorizing ESEA and fixing a lot of what's broken, we want to stop labeling so many schools' failures. We want to do a much better job of labeling schools' successes.
Microphone in front.
Good afternoon. I'm Mary Fertakis. I'm from the Tukwila School District in Washington State. We're the most ethnically diverse district in the country. And my question is, last year when you were speaking to us, you said that the department was going to shift to competitive grants. Do you really believe that our children should compete for their education?
IDEA funding, special ed, special needs students, Title I money for poverty students, 84% of our budget is formula-based, and always has been, always will be. So what I did say to be very clear is that we need to have some flexibility to reward excellence and drive change. And so literally, you know, more than four-fifths of our budget has been and will continue to be formula-based. Where we can have some competitive dollars, I think that's important as well. Let me just explain to you why. Race to the top, some people might like it, some people might not like it. That was $4 billion. As a country, we spent $650 billion a year on K-12 education. Less than 1% is spent. About less than 1% is spent, I think you've seen more reform in the past 2 years than you have in the past decade and a half. Without those kinds of incentives, I don't think we've seen 40 states raise standards. Without those kinds of incentives, I don't think you see 44 states working together with the next generation assessments. So folks love to say this versus that. Should children be competing for good education? Absolutely not. But I would tell you, there are millions of children today in this country who are getting an absolutely inferior education. And I'm going to continue to challenge the status quo to make sure they get a chance to be successful.
Thank you.
Commissioner, we thank you very much for being here. Both of my points have been touched upon, and to be honest with you, I didn't quite hear an answer about the relief that is absolutely non-controversial. You've got a broken system in Nickleby. You need to stop the punitive measures yesterday. How do you look at that? I understand where your political capital has to be.
And your question is, ma'am?
I need to know when you're going to give us relief, whether or not, okay, it passes the reauthorization in June.
So again, it's not whether or not, I think it's what are we all going to do to make sure we have a much fairer and flexible system for the country, and the goal is to have this done before we go back to school in the fall.
That's not an answer,
though,
sir. We have Pete.
Sir, microphone in front.
Yes, hi, Steve Kunkel from Pennsylvania, the only state with the distinction of losing twice to the Green Bay Packers. I'd like to ask Secretary Duncan about changing the focus on how we look at disaggregated data. The headline data that we always see is by ethnicity, and yet we know that the main issue in our schools as far as school performance is concerned is poverty. And when we disaggregate, and when the first thing that we look at is the ethnicity and how the data breaks out by that, we get distracted because it takes our eye off the real problem. And
the question is, sir?
I started with the question, sir, and I'm going to finish with the question.
Well, can you get to the question?
I'm getting to it. So I would like to ask if the Secretary can change the focus so that we're not looking at this in the first place, but that we're looking at how we disaggregate data by poverty. And your PISA Sputnik moment If you disaggregate that by data, this country is still doing very well in the public schools. There's just a little too much poverty, and the headline there should be,
sir,
we're number one.
Please, sir.
We are number one in childhood poverty.
That's a great question. I think we have to cut data lots of different ways. I would actually dispute your analysis of a piece of data. If you look at, they actually wrote a book for me on how we compare to other countries. And if you look at our middle-class white children versus middle-class white children in other countries, we're actually getting beaten pretty bad there, too. So it's not like our middle-class white children are somehow leading the world and somehow poor children are pulling down our country. That's just not reality. And so we all have to get better. But looking at different ways to cut the data and looking at the effects of poverty and how we challenge that, how we give children from poor communities a chance to be successful, disaggregate along those lines, I think anything we can do to be sophisticated in that analysis to really address what's going on. Many more wraparound services, after-school program, a huge fan of community centers. I think there's a lot we can do to alleviate the challenges that the poverty brings to the education system. We have to take them on openly and honestly. And there are, again, many places around the country that are taking high poverty, high minority children, and doing extraordinarily well with them.
We have time for three more questions. We start with the microphone in the back.
My name is Don Hubler from Lions Creek Public Schools. We know that the most common factor at-risk schools is the economically challenged environment that they're in. Can you say that it's mission accomplished as far as addressing IDEA and Title I? And before you go on, to make competitive grants to the districts that are least capable of competing for those grants?
Oh, no, it's not anywhere close to being mission accomplished. So IDEA is still nowhere near where federal funding should be. Again, my management public schools, I fill about a $770 million hole each year. So I'm acutely aware of that. We try to raise IDEA funding every single year. We double funding through the Recovery Act. Same thing on Title I money, a long way to go. So nowhere close to being mission accomplished. Again, where I would argue, where you and I might disagree a little bit, is thanks in part to things like raising top standards got raised. And guess who gets hurt most when standards are dumbing down? Poor minority children. And so these things are not accomplished. We've got to do both. We have to keep fighting for IDEA funding. We have to keep fighting for Title I funding. And we need to challenge the staff.
Second question, microphone in the front.
Good afternoon, Mr. Secretary. My name is Sunita Lanier from Grand Rapids, Michigan. As you're considering the reauthorization of NCLB, will you consider removing the 20% set aside for supplemental ed services and allow school districts to utilize those funds to hire highly qualified teachers to be able to provide the one-on-one and small group tutoring for our students ourselves?
We're not considering it. It's exactly what we're recommending.
This is the last question. Dr. Paul in the back.
Secretary, thanks for taking our call. Oh, my question. Ferndale Public Schools, Ferndale, Michigan. My question is, do governors or State Department of Ed have the discretion to accept the reform model for to restructure high school designated as failing or persistently below achieving based on one test score on one day in 1 month. Yeah, for quick context, it's an urban high school that we created in 2005. Only 3 graduating classes, 98% African American, 100% graduation rate, 100% college acceptance rate, and over 71% retention rate in 2 years of college. Yeah, because of one test in math, and we're on the persistently low achieving
your question,
ranks.
Sir.
I asked him, do we have any other method of appeal besides the State Board of Education?
If you want to shoot me an email, I'd love to look at that. My whole thing is how to get more students graduating from high school and being successful in post-secondary education. It sounds like you're doing an extraordinary job on that. And if that's the case, again, by no means you're a failure. We should be celebrating, recognizing, rewarding that kind of hard work.
Secretary Duncan, we really appreciate your time and all that you're doing for us in public education. And ladies and gentlemen, it doesn't matter if you agree with him or not, he is our best hope of getting any kind of changes and reform.